I want to begin. First of all, we want to welcome everyone for coming for this special shiur. We thank Rabbi Shai Schechter for arranging it. This evening we have the distinct pleasure to host Rabbi David Gottlieb. Rabbi David Gottlieb is a Ram at Yeshivat Har Etzion, where quite a number of the children of our members study for the year or two. And it's really a unique opportunity for them when they go to Eretz Yisrael. It's an opportunity for them to really gain tremendously from mashpiyim, from people, individuals who are talmidei chachamim, who are infusing them with a love ava for Torah and for Torah study, and for Torah study that will not just be there for their years when they're at yeshiva, but far beyond when they come back and they attend colleges and throughout life. And it's really those types of relationships that Rabbi Gottlieb fosters with his Talmidim. He's also an old dear friend going back in the years when we were YU together and Kol together and rabbinic colleagues together. And Baruch Hashem, he was...
Not that old.
Not that old. I was a little older, now it's on tape, but that's true. But certainly young at heart, young in spirit, and blazed his way with his family making Aliyah a few years ago. And it's just a big schuss for us to have Rabbi Gottlieb with us this evening.
When is this year usually?
Do I get an hour? 45 minutes? 50 minutes?
As long as you want.
When I see people running for the door, that'll be my sign. Okay, anyway, thank you very, very much, Rabbi Axelrod. I very much appreciate being here, and I echo the sentiments to thank my very young friend, Rav Shai, as well as my very old friend, Rabbi Axelrod, for being the liaison almost a year ago, I guess, or so. I think last year also I spoke in the shul, in the main shul. Thanks, Rav Shai. So I very much appreciate it. I happen to have two sisters who live in the neighborhood. So when I travel for the yeshiva, my home base is Woodmere, and the home base of Woodmere is the youngest of Woodmere. So I very much appreciate being here, and I'm always happy. I'm even happier to teach your children when they're in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. But my second thing is to be happy to teach you Torah, here. I'd like to speak about a topic which is dear to my heart because I need work on this as much as anybody, and that is our davening. My general sense is that when you think about the Mishnah Pirkei Avos of the world stands on three things, I think Torah and Talmud Torah is one which, there's always room to grow, but overall, writ large, our community is getting better and better. Base Medrash program here and similar phenomenon throughout the country. People are really learning well, Baruch Hashem. Chesed, our community is unparalleled, constantly doing things. I think the Achilles heel in many communities, certainly the ones that I'm familiar with, is still that middle one, Avoda. Davening, for some reason, can be difficult for a lot of people, even people who are learning and in real well-meaning. Many years ago in the Gush Beis Medrash, Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal got up and in the midst of everything else that he was saying in his perfect Hebrew, he quoted something in Yiddish that he heard from Rav Soloveitchik. So Rav Soloveitchik used to say that most people don't want to daven, they want to be eiskedavened. It's a very deep and profound insight. To actually daven, to do the work, to go through the Avodah Shebelev, to have a relationship with Hashem, not so exciting. But to be yaitze, to check the box, done, to be eiskedavened, to get it over with, that we all want to do. So why is that? Why is davening so difficult for so many of us? So I think, honestly, there are probably many reasons which affect different people to varying degrees. And since I was only invited to give one shiur and not a series, so we won't be able to discuss all of them, although I'm open to being invited back. I'm greedy when it comes to opportunities to teach Torah. The rest of my life, I'm a little bit more modest. But I would like to focus on one which, for some people, I think may be the main, but for everyone, I think, to some extent, is what really can be a burden and be a challenge to us. And that is the irony that the sitter itself, for many of us, is the problem. I'm not referring to the very common, typical issue of we don't understand what we're saying. That'd be a different shear to talk about that. But what I mean to say is the very fact that we say the same words over and over again, day after day, which, by the way, are not even my own words. They're someone else's words from all those years ago. I think that makes it very, very difficult, at least for many of us. And I think to some extent, it's not at all surprising. As Chazal point out, Rashi quotes it, source number one, from the Kriya Shema, just in general, human nature is that when something is new, it's kechadasha, hakol rotzen lekrasa. New is exciting. Saying the same words over and over again is just not exciting. Moreover, if that's true for every aspect of our life, including our religious life, you know, again, easy example, certainly for the men in the room, right? Bar mitzvah boy in tefillin. There's something unbelievably special and magical the first time. But after that, you know, certainly those of you who either had the experience or who had sons who had the experience, it loses its excitement. So that's true, I think, in all human experiences, and it's certainly true in all mitzvos. But it's particularly problematic and potentially devastating when it comes to davening more than any other mitzvah. For the simple reason, as we all know, also from Chazal, quoted here, I have it in source number two, Chazal define the mitzvah of davening not as something that we do with our mouth or our body, chovas evarim, as it were, but rather, as the Gemara says in source number two, eizu hi avoda shebelev, hevi omer zu tefillah. So of course, if you give tzedakah, you bake challah, you do any 100 mitzvahs, blow the shofar, shake the lulav, of course, more kavanah you have, the more meaningful it is. But at least with the other mitzvahs, anything you can imagine, there is the actual concrete mitzvah, and then there's the extent to which we can make it even more meaningful by infusing it with kavanah. But at least in theory, you can talk about the mitzvah even absent the kavanah. What the Gemara here is telling us is that is simply not true when it comes to tefillah. The definition of tefillah is the heart. It's not something that's supplementary or complementary. It is the essence of the mitzvah. Uniquely so, more than any other mitzvah. So if you have a mitzvah which is supposed to be in its essence all about the heart, and then you create a situation in which the maisa, the action that is supposed to inspire the heart, is not one that is new and exciting, but is repetitious and redundant day after day after day, it is not at all a surprise that people can lose touch with what's supposed to be meaning, and that habit can turn to rote. It's almost as if the system is working against itself. It's like a circle, you know, it's like a circular firing squad. How are we supposed to have kavana if by nature what gets us excited and gives relevance to us is something that's new and fresh? And this is something that's supposed to be in our hearts. And yet, I'm doing the same thing over and over again. Now, obviously, I know that there are people who daven well and meaningful and people transcend this. But don't you think that there's a certain limitation or vulnerability or danger that seems to almost be baked into the system? The very fixed text that Chazal established for us seemed to be one of, if not the single biggest impediment to having kavanah, which Chazal says is the essence of davening. And what I'd like to do is to try to explore with you how we can overcome that. Because I think if we can identify that as a natural challenge to tefillah, I think Chazal were plenty smart enough to figure that out as well. And it's not like the alternative is so difficult that no one could have conceived of it. I know from my experience, both of the Shul Rav, I used to teach in seminaries, I've taught in Shalvim, I now teach in Gush, I've taught many boys and girls across the spectrum, I've taught, you know, adults. Not everybody, but many, many people have said to me in one degree or next, you know, if I could just talk to Hashem in my own words, if I could just do it, but you know, just the sitter, it doesn't speak to me, and day after day, the same thing, and if that's, I think, a built-in weakness or vulnerability to our system to consider, then it must be, right? I just think pre-force, it must be that there's some, or maybe even multiple, benefits of the fixed text, which perhaps we aren't sufficiently sensitive to. I think to some extent, the sitter, the fixed text, at least in some contexts, can get a bum rap as if it's the impediment. It's a challenge, but I would like to explore with you is perhaps what might be often overlooked benefits to having a fixed text which we repeat day after day, week after week. I don't think that by understanding the three or four ideas I want to share with you, that will necessarily solve all the problems or make everyone's davening all of a sudden like an Elah every single day. But I do think that the more we can appreciate some of these hidden or underappreciated benefits of having a fixed text, I think some will resonate with each of you, some maybe multiple ideas will, and it is certainly my hope that this will be a shiur which will not only be lilmod, but also la'asos, will help you in your davening. Now, the first thing I'd like to kind of point out to you, we won't read it all inside, but in sources 3 and 4, you have the Gemara and then the very famous elaboration of the Rambam, which describes the origin or evolution or history of how the Siddur has come about, or certainly the essence of the Siddur, which is Shmona Esrei. Some of you may be familiar with this, but it's worth reviewing in brief, not only because we should just know it, but I think it highlights the assumption that we're working with from the outset. The Gemara tells us in source number 3 that Chazal, from the Anshe, time of the Anshe Knesset HaGedola and Yavne, were histier. They organized what was originally traditionally known as the 18 brachos, the Shmona Esrei. And the Gemara tells us there, where it's underlined, Kuf Ches Zekenim, there were 120 great Chachamim, Ubehem, and among them, Kama Nevi'im, even prophets, there were Tiknu, the 18 brachos al HaSeder. Now, of course, if that occurred during a particular period in history, during Anshe Knesset HaGedola, what that clearly means, by definition, is that before that point, they didn't have a fixed text. Now, there is a well-known machlokes, which some of you may be familiar with, whether mid'oraisa, from the Torah, there was an obligation to daven every day, or perhaps not, maybe only in times of crisis or not. But whether or not there was an obligation to daven every day, I think it's both intuitive and universally agreed upon that there was a concept of tefillah well before this, right? From the Avos on through. It only became formalized in a fixed text during this period of history, the Anshe Knesset HaGedola. But they did daven before then, apparently just without a fixed text. So why did they create a fixed text at all in Dafka at this time in history? So this is what the Rambam tells us and adds in source number 4. The Rambam himself does hold of the opinion, as I alluded to in the first line of number 4, that there is a daily obligation to daven. But even the Rambam, who holds there's an obligation to daven every day, tells us at the end of the first line, very famously, Ein minyan hatfilos min haTorah, how many times a day you daven? That was totally up to you. Ve'ein mishnah hatfilah hazos min haTorah, the nusach, the text, was totally independent. Ve'ein letfilah zman kavua min haTorah, and the specific time of day, got to say shacharis by this time, mincha by that time, none of that's daraisa, even according to the Rambam, who holds that there's an obligation in theory, or in the abstract to daven, but it was very, very subjective. How often you davened a day, what you said during the day, and what time of day you said it was all up to the person. And the Rambam then goes on to explain what, that there's a structure, that even if you use your own words, you have to start off by praising God, you end off by thanking God, and in the middle you can ask. He says that's also Daraisa. But where did the text come from specifically? So the Rambam describes here, I'll just paraphrase it, where it's underlined at the bottom of source number 4, the Rambam describes that this is a result of galus, of dispersion. People got, there was galus, there was churban, and people lost, it's just fascinating, they lost the fluency and they lost the facility to be able to speak to Hashem in their own words. And the Rambam says it again, where it's underlined in the middle of number 4, Mipnei zeh, kashay echem hen mispalel, tikatzer lishono, lishol chafatzov, ulahagid sheva kodesh baruch hu b'loshon ha-kodesh, ad shi'arvu imo lishonos acheros. They got all mevulbal, they got confused, they couldn't figure out how to say it in one language. V'kaven shara Ezra, beis dino, kach omdu v'tignu lehem shmon esrei brachos ala seder. Why am I stressing this? Because you see from Chazal, and especially by the Rambam's elaboration, that the ideal and the original conception of tefillah was not a fixed text. The original, everything that we're saying is kind of the assumption. You might have been thinking it's like iconoclastic, it's so controversial. Who is this guest rabbi? He's saying that the sitter is somehow less than ideal. This is clearly what the Torah always, at least initially intended, was for people to be able to speak to Hashem. The Rambam says explicitly in their own language, in their own words, at whatever time, as often as they wanted. And yet, at that period in history, Chazal came in and formalized so much. What time of day, how many times a day, and our topic, the language that we use to speak to Hashem. And I just stress this because I think it just begs the question. It's not only intuitive that a fixed text that's repeated day after day might make Kavana difficult. Clearly, the Torah never initially conceived of that, which further begs the question, so then why make the change? And again, my proposition is that if that was not the initial conception, and there's an obvious danger to it, it must be that the benefits are so overwhelming that the pros outweigh the cons, or at least make it worth taking the risk of davening becoming too habituated, too habitual. So now what's before us for the remainder of the shiur is to try to figure out in what way is it in fact true? In what way does the fixed text in fact help us? In what way, despite its inherent challenges, can it in fact be the greatest source of our connection to Hashem? And time permitting, I would like to share a few different ideas with you. They're not mutually exclusive. I happen to think that they're all true, and more or less, I think that each of them, or at least I hope at least one of them, will resonate with each of you, and hopefully perhaps even more, because I think each of them have the ability to really help enhance our davening. So the first answer I'd like to suggest to you is kind of what I would call the most minimalist approach, and that is that even though we, by which I mean some people or many people, often sincerely believe, and in fact sometimes if they feel, you know, safe, will even articulate this feeling of frustration with the sitter and, oh, I wish I could just, you know, talk to Hashem in my own voice, etc. The first, most minimal answer, I think that we'll get to some more ambitious or maximalist answers as we continue, but the first answer is we just have to be honest that despite the fact that we really believe that and we really mean it, most of us would be completely lost without the sitter. And in fact, we desperately need the fixed text. I'll explain what I mean in a few minutes, but just to illustrate that, I want to share with you an amazing phenomenon that you find in the Gemara in source number 5. The Gemara tells us that the basic Shmon Esrei is the 18 brachos. It ends at Sim Shalom. Now, has anyone here ever ended Shmon Esrei after Sim Shalom? No, you haven't.
Hey, you
Ah, come on, Wallach. Oh, yeah. This is my friend and my former Talmud who spent 2 years in the Darkeinu program in Gush. We call him Rabbi Wallach in the yeshiva. And now he's back in Cedarhurst. What do we say after Shmon Esrei? After the Sim Shalom? And don't be fancy. What do we really say? Elokein Etzor. It's clear, the Gemara is explicit. This is the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Yud Zayin. That wasn't initially part of the Shmon Esrei. It's not even officially part of it now, but it never used to exist. The Gemara describes that after they were Koveya, the set text of the Shmon Esrei, various Chachamim added their own individual petitions. So the Gemara gives examples. The Gemara source number 5. Rabbi Alexandri Basar Tzalusei Omer Hachi. This particular rabbi, who most of us never heard of, Rav Alexandri, after he would finish the Shmon Esrei, the 18 brachos, he would say the following: Ribon Ha'olamim, Goli V'yadua Lefanecha, Shiratzoneinu, Lasos Ritzoncha, Umim Akev, Sor Sheb Isa, V'shibonachas. His particular personal petition would be, Hashem, you know that we really, really, really want to do the right thing. Nu, Mervas, what happens? We have a Yetzer Hara, the guy, you make it difficult for us, we fall short. That was, he used to add that personal tefillah. And then he gives other examples. Or another rabbi, after he would daven, would say, Elokai, Ashlono Tzarti, Eni Kadai, Achashenot Tzarti, Ilono Tzarti. We're all familiar with that. Where does that come from? Right? V'yamim Narayim, after the Vidui. So this Rav said it every day for every Shemona. That's when he said it. We have adopted it. Our minhag is that we say it after Vidui in the Yamim Narayim. The Gemara continues. Marbrader of Enoch, you have a Messiah, Tzlusa Amrachi, Elokain Etzor, Lashoni Meira, Susai Medaber Mirmam, Lakali Navshi Tidom. Of course, that we all familiar, because somehow that opinion was Zaycha to make it into the article sitter, even before the article. That became the minhag. That became part of our Nusach. Why am I stressing this? Think about it for a second. And what I'm telling you now is more or less the Ha'ara of the Tzlach, the author of Note of Yehuda in his commentary to the Gemara. Everything I just described evolved as I just said it. That is to say, initially in the first generations, the Chazal had gone from having their own personal, unique, subjective tefillos. Then they instituted this official, formal, objective tefillah. So what did the various Chachamim do? After having been given this fixed text, they still wanted an opportunity to speak to Hashem in their own voice, to use their own words. There's no indication whatsoever in this Gemara that these various Rabbanim were authoring a tefillah that should be adopted by Klal Yisrael. Basar Ditzalusa Amrachi. This was their personal tefillah. But what happened? What started off as something personal, which might have been for this rabbi and not for that one, he said it today, but he didn't say it tomorrow because it wasn't really necessary. It was just a personal, spontaneous thing. It ended up over time, and honestly, I'm not a historian of tefillah. I don't know exactly, or I don't know if anyone knows, and I still don't know exactly when it became, in all seriousness, when did Elokein Etzor become a fixed part of our Sidurim? I honestly don't know. But the Tzlach points out, it happened. The very types of tefillos which the Chazal themselves started saying as a reaction to the fixed text, let's at least add a little individuality, a little spontaneity to it. What did we do as a people, as a nation? We institutionalized and formalized that and said everyone should say that every day. It's an unbelievable irony. Now, why do I think that happened? Because, as I alluded to before, because despite all of our best interests and sincere feelings, as human beings, we desperately need someone else's words. We need to make it our own with our kavana, but left to our own devices. Sure, Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, feel free. Hashem is there for you, whatever you want. Most of us would have no idea how to begin. How long do you think our davening would really be? I know this is a tempting proposition for you, but how long would it really be if we just, whatever you want, in your own words, please, no, really, for you, for Hashem, it's, the floor is yours. How much, we don't even know where to begin. You know when this was brought home to me? Mr. Leibowitz is here, father of one of my old closest friends from YU, Barry Leibowitz. So Barry Leibowitz indirectly was responsible for my shidduch. Because after our first year together in YU, Barry's parents would not let him get engaged right away. He met his wife in Hesk, which is the true place for all good shidduchim. But his parents said, you're too young, you can't get married yet. So they had to wait a whole other year, and they didn't get engaged until after the next summer. But that summer, after they'd already been in Hesk, they said they're going to go to YUSSR. Because his son and daughter-in-law are great people, and they wanted to do Kiruv in the former Soviet Union. I wasn't such a big thinker. I wanted to go learn in Marsha Kolo. Everybody says, you know, maybe you should think about coming to YMSSR. Long story short, I went to Russia for the summer, and I happened to meet my wife there. She's from Staten Island, but that's another story. And she's not from Russia. Well, you know, nothing personal. But we happened to meet in YMSSR, so Baruch Hashem, they have a big indirect say in my shidduch. When we were in Russia, trying to give these kids a fun, wonderful summer, and also teach them a little bit of Yiddishkeit after 70 years of forced atheism, so one of the main things we used to do is teach them how to daven. And we had special translated Sidurim, phonetically and otherwise, into Russian. And I remember the first month, I had one of like the 13-year-old boys. And every day we would teach them a new tefillah of the Shemona Esrei. And I'll never forget the days leading up to when I was going to get to Shema Kolenu. I made a big deal about it. You know, until now you've been saying this and this, but we're going to get to this magical bracha of Shema Kolenu. And, you know, there's going to be this place and we're going to pause and you can say whatever you want to Hashem in your own words. And it's going to be so incredible. And I thought, you know, that's going to be incredible. So sure enough, we get to the day and I say, okay, we're now at this place. We've been talking about it for a few days. We're all going to pause and you can ask God for anything you want. And when I tell you these people need everything, you cannot imagine. You've never seen poverty unless you've been to the former Soviet Union. We know nothing of real poverty in our world. Desperate. They had nothing. There were so many things they could ask for. I said, and just so that everyone should feel comfortable, we're all going to close our eyes, and each person can speak to God in whatever language you want, and after 10, 15 seconds, we'll keep up with it. So sure enough, the first day we got to that, I gave the whole spiel, we're ready to go. Everyone, including me, goes like this. We close our eyes. And then after about 1 second, I went like this. Because I was curious what's going on. And you know what was going on? Absolutely nothing. My 19-year-old idealistic self was crushed. I thought I was like this incredible teacher and I prepared them and they were going to have this incredible spiritual experience and talk to God. And nothing happened. Now you could tell me it was uniquely situation, they were a little younger and the whole background. Yes, it's all true. But I suggest, and I am convinced, it wouldn't be that different if I did it with all of you in this shul, or in Borough Park, or in Ramat Beit Shemesh, or in Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh. It is incredibly hard to just speak to Hashem. We, in our moments, especially in desperation, we figure out ways to do it. But to consistently, on a daily basis, talk to Hashem on our own, I think Chazal understood we wouldn't be able to do it. Every now and then, maybe. So the number one thing we should realize is maybe it's a crutch, but sometimes you need a crutch. And I think we should consider that very often the alternative would be far worse. We don't appreciate it, but number one, again, this is not saying all the greatest shakes for the sitter yet, but just more minimalistic, I think we should just first be honest about our own limitations as human beings. Not so easy to do what we think would be so much better. To do it consistently, I think it'd be almost impossible. So number one is, I think minimally, we need the sitter. Number one. Number two is, for those of you who are mystically inclined, I'm a little bit less, but for those of you who might be, it's important just so you should see the full range of things. The Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner points out that there's a second benefit to the sitter. The Nefesh HaChaim points out that, as we read, and I stressed it when I was reading the Gemara, Chazal said not only did a lot of great rabbis write the sitter, write the Shemona Esrei, Umehem Kama Nevi'im. There were prophets. Let me ask you a question. You really think you needed to be a prophet to write our Shemona Esrei? It's so complicated. It's such great shakes. We're familiar with rabbinic literature or medieval poetry, the kinos, the slichos, the various piyutim. There's some incredibly complex, liturgical, poetic texts in our tradition. And Shemona Esrei is not one of them. Are you really going to tell me that if I got together a few really smart and sensitive people, you and I couldn't have figured out to some version of Rifa'enu? To figure out, you know, the Piyutim or the Slichos, that, you know, you had to be Rav Elazar HaKalir to do that. But Shemona Esrei is not so complicated and so sophisticated. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner, what did you need Nevi'im for? Only the greatest Chacham Nevi'im could do it? It's not so overwhelming. So says Rav Chaim Volozhiner, you know, you're missing it. Because in addition to the obvious meaning of all the brachos in the Shemona Esrei, he points out in source number 6, every one of these brachos include Beruach kotcham, he says, hasagas nevuasam hel yono unihirilu shvilin de kol sidre beraisas uperkei merkava. You think you're just davening for rain in Parnassa. You think you're just davening for kibbutz golius. You think you're just davening for a gugazunt in refuah shalema. That's the simple meaning of the words. But each and every one of those words is affecting elyonos and the olam and tachtonim and nachra elyonim and the figuring out of tikkunim and all sorts of stuff, which I in no way dismiss and in no way understand. But to the extent that, you know, that appeals to people and it resonates with you, says Rechaim Volozhin, every word. So it's true. Maybe in your own you could daven and just ask God for, you know, a raise or a new job or something like that. But you think in your own words you'd be able to figure out things that could be misaking the whole Olamos and all the Kabbalah and the mysticism? Of course we couldn't. How could we? The Sadr Chaim Voloshner. That's why we didn't just need Chachamim to write the Tefillah. We needed Nevi'im. People with Ruach HaKodesh. Again, most people I know can't really appreciate that as they're going through the Shemoneh Esrei, right? But to the extent that some of you may be mystically or spiritually inclined, so that's something to keep in mind. That at least one possible benefit of having that sitter is you think you're just davening for things you need. You think you're just asking Hashem for peace in Eretz Yisrael, which is good, we need that too. But you're also doing all sorts of other things. So that's a second possibility. Number one is, again, we need it. We think we need it, we don't think we need it, we sometimes get frustrated by it, but really, really, I think, honestly, we just need it. Number two is, there's a lot of stuff in that Shemoneh Esrei you don't even realize. The Chachamim, especially the Nevi'im, they jam-pack that tefillah with all sorts of special mystical things. Number three. Would like to, time permitting, I'd like to do two or three more ideas, and then we'll hopefully conclude as well. But number three, I think, is also an important point. I believe in one of his lectures, maybe in one of his books, I heard from the former chief rabbi of England, Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, that he pointed out that the sitter, I think this is a great observation, the sitter, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember exactly how he put it, but his basic idea was that the sitter was Chazal's book of comprehensive hashkafa. People often ask, how come Chazal didn't write a book of Hashkafa? This is not our topic, but everyone asks, how come it was only the Rambam who wrote the Gimli Karim? Where did he make these up from? What happened in Chazal? Only Povasham here and there. There are little scattered things. So his answer to the question is, Chazal did write a book of comprehensive Hashkafa. It's called the Sitter. Now, without developing his point, it relates to us in a way that is parallel to an idea mentioned in the Sefer HaKuzari in source number 7. And that is, Kuzari is talking about why it's important to daven in public, in a minyan. But I think what he says in parallel is similar to what I'd like to say about the nusach of tefillah. And that is, by Chazal choosing what we daven for, they're also telling us what's appropriate to daven for. There's a hashkafa in what is being chosen and what is not included. I think there's a hashkafa, even more subtly, in the order of the brachos. You want to know what's important? You want to know what's truly important in life? Look at what Chazal chose to emphasize. Look at what they included. Do you think there's a more eloquent, albeit subtle, but a more dramatic or eloquent illustration or expression of how much we value learning Talmud Torah, an intellectual, engaged connection to Hashem? Can there be a better, more eloquent, more dramatic example of that than the fact that the very first opportunity we have to ask Hashem for anything every single day, of all the things we could ask for, what's the first thing we ask for? Atachonen Adam Das. There's a hashkafa behind that. What's important in life? Right? I'm not poo-pooing all sorts of other materialistic things, but there is no bracha for Alexis. And when it came time to make a bracha against anybody, the 19th bracha, that was done with incredible deliberation and took a special person, Shmuel HaKatan. I remember my first year in YU, I remember hearing of Herschel Schechter in a talk in the Reuben Shul on a Friday night, speaking about Rav Kook's approach to that bracha, and why it was so important, so difficult, to have the right kavanas for that bracha, because the default in Judaism is we don't daven against anybody. That's not our way. So in fact, that's what the Kuzari says about the need for a minyan. He says if everyone was just left to their own devices, somebody, you know, cut you off at the bank or got into a fight in the PTA or something like that, you might want to daven against them. And therefore, the Kuzari, giving his example of a minyan, says, no, we daven in a group as part of a community so that our tefillos don't become selfish and myopic. So I would suggest analogously, similarly, the Nusach, Chazal are teaching us not only what to daven for, but not only how to daven, but what to daven. I remember a number of years ago, in all seriousness, and again, I have nothing against people driving nice cars at all, Chas v'Shalom, don't misunderstand me, but there's one of my favorite Reb Chaim Kanievsky story, which is one of those stories which I would say is too good to verify. So let's assume that it happened, and if it did, it's the best story I ever heard about Bnei Brak. Anyone ever hear the Reb Chaim Kanievsky Lexus story? But he doesn't drive one, though, you shouldn't get confused with me. The story goes that there was a fellow wealthy businessman who decided, instead of working to his last year to make even more money, he decided to make Aliyah, and he moved to Bnei Brak, and after years of working and never having time to learn, he's going to use whatever years Hashem gave him to learn. And he sold his big house in Flatbush or wherever, and he moved to Bnei Brak. He's living a much more simple life, and he's going to Kollel, and he's learning, and making up for all the time that he didn't have a chance to learn when he was heading his business. But one thing he couldn't give up was his car, was his Lexus. And he was driving around Bnei Brak. And his wife kept on telling him, Yankel, you can't, people are poor here, they have simple lives, I'm embarrassed to be seen with you in this car, you have to give it up. And he kept on saying to her, but I gave up everything to come here and learn, the one thing, can I keep the car? And back and forth, and finally she says, go ask Reb Chaim. So he goes into Reb Chaim, and he tries to explain his background, who he is, and he tells him, I have this Lexus, and I understand there's so much poverty in Bnei Brak, etc. What do you think, is it appropriate or not, whatever the Rebbe says, I'll do? So I would have thought the first thing Reb Chaim Kanievsky would have said is, what's a Lexus? But I guess he knew, because that's not part of the story. So he says to him, tell me something. Have you gone through Shas? He says, Rebbe, maybe I thought I was clever. I spent the last 40 years working. I never had a chance to really learn. That's why I came. Pat on the back. Oh, so you don't know Shas. Look, tell me something. One of the Shisha Sidre of Shas, Nashim, Ezekiel, is there a Seder of Shas at least that you know? And he's, no, Rabbi, I was working for so many years, I never really had time to learn, but that's what I'm here now. A Seder you don't know. Okay. So stuff like, is there one Masechta? Gemara Rashi does, is there one Masechta you know cold? And at this point, he's not either frustrated or embarrassed, or both. So Rabbi, I'm telling you, I haven't really had that much time to learn over these years. That's why I'm here now. He says, let me tell you something. If you don't even know one Masechta, there ain't nobody in Bnei Brak who's going to be jealous of anything about you. Now, I don't know if that really, really happened, but I hope it did. Because that would be the best Bnei Brak story I ever heard. Right? No community is perfect, including Bnei Brak. But that represents the best of a community that's so focused on Torah to the exclusion of material things. So knowing what's important in life and what we should be jealous for is a milah, and knowing what we should daven for is also a milah. And not that there can't be individual circumstances. We'll get to, I hope by the end of this year, the idea of personalized tefillah. I haven't forgotten about that yet, and everyone's wondering, doesn't he know that we're allowed to add things? Yes, I do. We'll get to that. But the fact that Chazal created a basic system, the standard tefillah, it's not just to make it easier for us, the first answer. It's not just because it's helping us with Kabbalah and and all the mystical stuff. But it's also telling us, as a default, as a standard, what are the values that, for most people over most time, are what we should be davening for, what's important to us. If you turn over the page, I'd like to share two more ideas, similar but slightly different from Rav Soloveitchik, and then we'll be able to move towards the conclusion. Rav Soloveitchik, both in Hashkafa and in his Halachic or Lamdus analysis, has many well-known ideas, but perhaps his most famous idea, arguably his most famous idea, which he proves in many of his writings, Hebrew and English, Halacha and Hashkafa, is the idea that for many mitzvos, it's not sufficient to just do the mechanical or physical action, the Maisa mitzvah, but in fact, there's this other thing which he says is equally, if not more important, called the Kiyum HaMitzvah, that there's a certain feeling or thought in the heart or mind which must be accompanied or engendered by the physical action. And in fact, that is what I like to call the cha-ching moment. It's not just the doing it, but it's that feeling, the kiyum shebelev. That's a well-known idea you've probably heard over the years. Eris Rabbanim mentioned this in one form or another. But in this particular essay you have in source number 9, Soloveitchik actually turns the question on its head, which is, if the kiyum, if that cha-ching, that moment of closeness to Hashem through the heart, if that's really what's so important, so taka, why do we have the requirement for the Maisa Mitzvah? Let whatever you tell me is supposed to be the kiyum of shofar, and let's tell everyone to just feel that. What are we going to go blow the shofar for? Tell me what's the kiyum shebelev, the feeling is supposed to be when I shake the lulav, and just tell me and I'll do that feeling. What do I have to shake a lulav for? So in order to answer that question, Soloveitchik says something very, very beautiful. And it, of course, overlaps with exactly our topic. If you look at the underlying part of source number 9, 4 lines down in the middle, he says, in the performance of Kriya Shema, of Tefillah, of Avelus, of Simchas Yom Tov, etc., we recite a fixed and standardized text, and we perform precise, and I'd add fixed, ritual acts. Yet the real consummation, the kiyum, as I said, is actually realized in the experience, belave. So you'll ask, if that's the case, I'm paraphrasing the next few lines. So if really the kiyum, the cha-ching, is what we feel in our heart, so then what do we need the action for? So says Rav Soloveitchik, if you continue where it's underlined, before that, 3 lines below. First, the religious emotion is volatile, ever-changing and unstable, even within one individual. To correlate the outward act to the inner emotion would require regular adjustments. The mitzvah would continually have to be modified and at times nullified. The format and identity of the mitzvah would be destroyed, and no continuity of identifiable performance would be possible. So number one, even for each individual, we're volatile human beings. We're emotional. We're not robots. So the type of action which would be necessary, if all we cared about was the feeling, the thing that we would need to do to get us have that feeling would constantly be changing. There'd be no consistency in even a given mitzvah, because depending on my mood or what was going on, I would need to approach it differently. And number two, on a related point, he points out on the last 2 lines, is that no 2 people would be able to do the same thing, because each person would need a different way to express that emotion. No community of service of God would be possible, since group worship presupposes a unifying constancy. What I think he's getting at least the way I would apply it to davening, is that by having fixed mitzvos, in their example, or for our purposes, a fixed nusach hatfila, has the benefit of connecting us to something bigger, both chronologically. A person knows, a woman who lights Shabbos candles, she starts getting married, she's doing it in the same way her mother did it, and her grandmother, and her great-grandmother. I still remember when I got married, we lived in Manhattan at the time. I was working did my shimush, my internship for Rabbi Lookstein, and my wife was teaching in the city. So even though I was in the Kol NYU, but I used to go back and forth to the east side. And a few weeks after we got married, not the first week, but only a few weeks afterwards, my parents, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, they wanted to come to New York for Shabbos. And they have many relatives, but they wanted to stay in our little one-bedroom apartment on 85th between 2nd and 3rd. And I said, but we don't even have a guest room. It's okay, we'll stay on the pillow couch. I was the oldest. This is their first married child. They're very, very excited. And okay, it was fine. We had them, you know. They gave us like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks to, you know, have a little privacy. But then they wanted to come for Shabbos. I'll never forget. Can I know our last month, I had our 21st anniversary. I don't really remember what I did ate for breakfast this morning, but I do remember that Friday night, about a month after I got married 21 years ago, when I made Kiddush as a married man in our house for the first time with my father next to me. I'm not such a softy, but I couldn't make it through without having tears, and my father was for sure crying, and he's a tough guy. It was a magical moment. I was connecting. I grew up hearing my father say Kiddush, who grew up with his father's Kiddush. And now I was entering as a Jewish man into that Masorah. So that wouldn't happen if each of us could just make up our own Kiddush. The power of that moment came from the fact that we're each doing the same thing. So the ability to have consistent ritual or nusach connects us back, but also in any one time connects us with all Jews. It's true that nusach Sfarad and Ashkenaz are a little different than Hasidus, and if you go to some shul in Morocco, it'll be different than in Persia, which is different than in Borough Park, which is different than in Woodmere, which is different than Alon Shvut, which is different than in Ramat Beit Shemesh, but only to a degree. For the most part, even if you take the most wildly different tefillos, you all have had this if you've been on a vacation or something like that. What Jew can't walk into another shul and more or less figure out what's going on? We all can. That's beautiful. That's powerful. That connects us to something much bigger than ourselves. None of that, says Rav Soloveitchik, would be possible if everyone could just, based on the volatile emotions of the moment, just make up their own way to talk to Hashem. Would we gain something from it? We would. But what Rav Soloveitchik is alerting us to is, how much would we be losing? Rather than just be sometimes left cold or frustrated by the constant and consistent nusach, we should appreciate one of the incredible powers of it, and that it connects us. Whatever the little differences are, you grew up in a nusach Sfarad shtibul, and yeah, you go to a nusach Ashkenaz big shul, and your parent, you know, your mother's family is from Poland, and they daven this way. Yes. And no. No. The differences are negligible. For the most part, you know when you daven, you're connected not only to every Jew now, but to Jews that came generations and generations before you. That, self-salvation, is something powerful and something very, very significant. Last but not least on this point, I just want to conclude with one last idea before we wrap up, and that is I'll work off of what I think is going on in our Soloveitchik in source number 10. I think that there's a difference between what I would call in English rote and practiced. Rote is a problem. And that's what we've been speaking about. That isn't it true that by having the same nusach and the same shmona esrei day after day after day, it can become rote and we can lose our kavana and lose our feeling? Yes, it's a danger. We've been speaking about that. But there's something else which is similar but very different. It's not rote, but practiced. And in order to truly be great at anything, it has to become instinctive. It has to become part of you. That only happens if it's practiced. Lahavdil, you see this in almost any other area. Let's take, for example, theater. It's mamash a parallel, if you think about it. It's, you're looking, you see this great actor, actress. Is it the actor's words? No, someone else wrote it for them. If it's Shakespeare, they wrote it a long time ago. When you see a great performance of an incredible actor, actress, right? Part of the talent of that actor and of the power of the show is, you know, you really feel that, you know, the person, the character is really into that moment and really feels it in the words and everything. As if, you know, they're, you know, if they're, you know, if it's like a scene of great anger or pain, you know, you, if it's a good show, it's a real professional performance, you feel it. It's there. You feel the anger, you feel the angst. Meanwhile, if you take a step back, it's an actor saying words that he or she didn't write. And how many times do you think they practiced those lines? You think it was really spontaneous because, you know, so-and-so, you know, killed his wife and therefore that's why? They've been practicing it over and over again. Because in order for them to actually give their emotion in the moment, it has to have been so practiced that it becomes one with them, so they're not spending all of their energy thinking about what word comes next. But rather, it just becomes natural part of their experience. A dancer, the same thing. A musician performing, they practice that piece time and time again so that it can become meaningful. The first time they performed it, yes, it was new, but it was awkward. Sports, anyone who follows sports, I'm a big sports guy, not just because I teach guys. That's my excuse to follow sports so that I can say I'm doing it for my Talmidim, but I probably would follow it anyway. Right? Baseball, basketball, right? I always say, if you have to think about it, you'll never get it, right? You got to think about the shot. You got to think about when to swing. You got to practice enough that it becomes instinctive. It becomes part of who you are. Yes, there's a fine line between practiced and rote, and we have to be on guard for that. But to think that somehow by saying the same thing over and over again, that's somehow damaging, On the contrary, while it's potentially, it's also the only thing that can really allow us to truly get into the tefillos. I'll mention something just very briefly. I don't know anyone's background here, but I certainly, over my years, I've certainly met or seen in various opportunities or current contexts, people who are recent Baalei Tshuva. I don't know if this applies to anyone here, but if not, you certainly, I assume, have seen this as well. On the one hand, there's nothing as inspiring as seeing a recent Baal Tshuva davening, and there's also nothing as painful. The pronunciations of the words are very difficult and unnatural. They're never exactly sure when to bend, when to do this. That's not a criticism. It's unbelievable that they even go through it. I'm lucky. I'm from birth. At some point, when they keep at it, we all know, not only does it become second nature to them, they can become the best novener, and they become the best noveners in the shul. But in that initial stage, when it's new to them, it's actually very difficult, not beautiful. Because they have to spend so much of their energy focusing on what to say, what to do, when to bow, when to this. It's not practiced at all. And in fact, all that energy and focus often diverts from their ability to really meaningfully commute to Hashem and have kavana. It's only after they get through that and it becomes practiced, then to their great credit, and hopefully as an inspiration to all of us, they can naturally say the words and know what to do and when to do, but use their energy, because as we all know, kavana takes effort. If you're spending so much time worrying about what to say and how to pronounce the words and other things, who's got time for kavana? So practiced, like Lahavdil, the great ballet dancer, the great basketball player, the great actor, makes something one with us. I once shared some of these ideas 2 summers ago on the NCSY Kollel with Rav Meir Tversky, one of my Rebbeim. I said to him, what do you think? He said, that last answer that you said, that's the true answer. He's big. And he gave me a mashal, which I didn't think of, and I wouldn't have thought he would have thought of. He said, it's just like yoga. I didn't ask him if he does yoga. But he said to me, it's just like yoga. He says, people, whatever that mantra, whatever the exact word is, that people who do yoga use to get themselves to relax and into the moment, he said, it doesn't matter what it is, but they do the same thing every time. If you have to think about it at the beginning of your yoga session, each time a new thing to think about, a new thing to get in touch with yourself, a new thing to relax yourself, it'll never happen. So by trial and error, you find something that works, and then you do the same thing every time. So that's exactly what tefillah is supposed to be. It becomes one with you. Once you get used to it and it becomes practiced, then you can reach those, what they call higher levels of consciousness, and we would call kavana. You know, the hour's late. We started a little bit late, but the hour's late. I want to stop in a few moments. I just want to wrap up, and we'll end with a story. The basic premise of the shiur was to ask the question, isn't it true that the nature of the sitter, the nature of our structured formal davening, seems to be our own worst enemy, and in many ways hampers the goal of what the sitter or what davening is supposed to be? I think on some level the answer is yes. It's a real challenge. We all know it, whether we usually admit it or not. So if that's the case, since we're not proposing, certainly not me, rejecting the sitter, so the question is, what can we appreciate? What the hidden values and treasures might exist in the fixed text, in the fixed nesach, which we can hopefully focus on the positives to helpfully outweigh the inherent chance that, after all, people like things that are new. Chazal knew that, Rashi knew that, and we all know that. So the fact that we repeat things over and over again creates a natural barrier, a natural challenge. So we suggested a few ideas. Perhaps one is, we should consider the alternative. It's not so good. We really do need a sitter. It's part of the limitations of being human. Number two, we mentioned there are all these mystical benefits, which, whether we may feel or not, but we believe, also exist in the fixed text. Number three, we mentioned that what we daven for in the sitter teaches us sound doctrine, teaches us hashkafa, teaches us what's important, what the Chazals think we should as a nation, not just uniquely as individuals, be davening for. Number four, we mentioned from Soloveitchik, the idea of connecting us to Jews of the past and even Jews throughout the world by the fact that we're all saying the same thing connects us to something bigger. And lastly, we mentioned, of course, the idea that something can become practiced. The more we say it, the more it becomes part of us, so that if we internalize it, we can then use our, hopefully, without worrying about what to do and what to say, we can then use our energy and intention to focus on a kavana and connecting with Hashem. Of course, it's true, and both in Hashkafa and especially in Halacha, I could give a whole separate shir on the idea of adding personal bakasha. There's no question that even though it doesn't answer why Chazal would give us a fixed text, but certainly one of the solutions to personalizing tefillah is to personalize tefillah. And we can add in various degrees, and your Rabbanim can give you the specific how-tos, even within individual brachas. You do not need to wait to Shema Kolenu necessarily, or Alokainetz, or there are all sorts of ways to add personal bakashas. And of course, the more we personalize the tefillah, the more it will be personalized, and the more we will connect to that. And that's in no way contradicts anything that we're saying, but of course it complements and supplements it as well. I'll just end with the following story. You know, sometimes, again, I've had this with adults, and I certainly have had this with teenagers. People often feel when they have a challenge with something, the biggest Yetzer Hara is when we tell ourselves, it's just us. Everyone else can daven well, you know, it's just me, that kind of thing. So just so we should realize how all of us can overcome this, but all of us are potentially vulnerable to this. I'll share with you in conclusion my favorite Satmar Rebbe story. I only have one, but it's my favorite Satmar Rebbe story. And the story goes, as any of you who have a Hasidic background know, that at Hasidic weddings, the highlight, of course, is the Batchan. So, you know, towards the end of, you know, the wedding, you know, when the little good friends and relatives are still there, the Batchan, who's been hired, usually a professional, gets all the information of the various sides and the chasan and the kala and the various family, and really writes this you know, really talented poems and rhymes and stuff to kind of put it all together. So apparently there was a wedding in Satmar, the Rebbe was going to be there, and I never heard or saw a tape or video of how the Rebbe davened, but apparently he had a unique voice or a unique way of davening. And this particular Batchan apparently did a spot-on imitation. And the story goes that in advance of the wedding, he knew the Rebbe would be there, he asked him, would it be okay if as part of my performance, you know, Simchas Chasan Vakala, Shem Shamayim, in good taste and respect, could I include my imitation of the Rebbe? And the Rebbe said, Michael's line's no problem, for sure, it's good. So they get to the wedding, and, you know, everything cleared away, and they bring out the Batchan, and he does this thing called the Chasan, and the Kala, and the Mechutanim, and the Mechatanist, and everything. And at some point, he gets to his performance, he includes his imitation of the Rebbe davening. And he notices as he's performing, the Rebbe is crying. So you can imagine what would a Satmar Chassid feel like in public giving a performance in which he's made the Rebbe cry. You cannot imagine something worse and more disastrous. So he runs over to the Rebbe and he's begging for forgiveness. I don't know what happened. I must have misunderstood. I thought the Rebbe said it was okay and I never would have done it if I knew you were a makbid and I'm so sorry and could the Rebbe forgive me? And he's like groveling, understandably. At which point the Rebbe stops and says, no, it's okay. He didn't do anything wrong. I'm not upset at all. He said, Rebbe, I don't understand. If I didn't do anything wrong, if I didn't hurt you, why are you crying? So he said something that's unbelievable. He said, when I saw how well you were imitating me, I realized how often I'm just imitating myself. I'm not a chassid of Satmar, but I am a devotee of that story. And that ability to be self-reflective and self-aware. We're all vulnerable to that chisaron. I would add, even if you're not a Rebbe, sitting in the front of the shul like a rabbi does is not conducive to kavana or sincerity. Because we're all human. We're all aware that other people are watching us. I know when I was a rabbi, I was particularly sensitive to how long my Shmon Esrei would be, because I know that the people are waiting for me, but I don't want them to wait too long. But if I go too fast, they think the rabbi's not from, and it's just some young YU guy in Baltimore, what's going on? And these things go through your mind, you're human. So at some point, I can't remember how long it was, but at some point I figured out what the magic number was. So I was always conscious of that. That is not exactly conducive to sincere Yirat Shamayim or sincere Avodas Hashem. But if the Satmar Rebbe could have that chisaron, for his own reasons, he didn't have the issues I had, but he sometimes felt like he was imitating himself. So I was also sometimes imitating myself. So rabbis for sure are not impervious to this. If anything, we're more vulnerable to this. But whether you're in the front of the shul or the back of the shul, the women's section or the men's section, the nature is definitional. The more we're saying the same thing over and over again, the more we're prone to this. So the answer is not to not say it or to skip every other day, although I once had a student who's made that suggestion. Last student, Gush, I want to point out, but a student I did. So that's not the answer either, obviously. The answer is, of course, to daven regularly as much as we can, as well as we can, but to be sensitive to and appreciate all the benefits that, in fact, Chazal have given us with this fixed nusach. And even though there are inherent challenges and dangers, but to nevertheless, like everything, with courage and with conviction, confront those, but hopefully focus through our learning and through our dedication on all the benefits, so that hopefully our davening can constantly improve. As Chazal says, it's one of the things that needs chizuk. We all have to work on it. If Rabbanim don't talk about it and people don't work on it, it will not get better. But in every community, here, there, and everywhere, it needs to improve. And the more hopefully we work on it and think about the benefits of it, the more our davening should be better, and the more Hashem hopefully should answer all of our tefillos l'tov. Thank you very, very much for coming. Have a good night.
How many people have not that margin?
That's a test.
Oh.